looking forward to our discussion with retired Judge Stephen Martin, who has written about an infamous case here in Vermont. I'm going to really resist the temptation to call it a murder case, because then, of course, the judge will rule me immediately out of order. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment here. We'd love to take your phone calls throughout the program as well, too, particularly any of you folks that live in Newberry. We'd love to hear from you this morning. I know the judge would, too. You can reach us at the usual phone numbers, 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin our number two. If you've lived in Vermont for any period of time, you may be familiar with the case of Orville Gibson, who lived down in Newberry and disappeared on New Year's Eve in 1957. A few months later, his body, and you should see the picture that Steve puts in this book. It is just incredible what Orville Gibson looked like after marinating in the Connecticut River for a couple of months. And he was found with his hands tied underneath his knees. And so the case was investigated. A couple of people were charged. Where Steve comes into play on this is as a young attorney, a young grasshopper in the legal community. He was working with Dick Davis, who's a pretty famous attorney here in Vermont. And they worked on this case together. And let me just tell you one small story about Dick Davis, and then we're going to chat with Steve here. In Dick Davis's obituary, he passed away in 1993. They said that he was known as a hardworking, charming, and brilliant lawyer. His peers judged him to be the best trial lawyer in Vermont. With his death on Monday, Vermont lost a man who was a dominant figure in the state's courtrooms, a lawyer who had been associated with some of the most notorious trials of recent years. He won a lot of cases that many believed unwinnable, and there was a murder case where he convinced a jury that a man who had been found in a river with his hands and feet bound had committed suicide. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Stephen Martin, who's the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. I've been pretty good. I haven't called it a murder case except for reading that thing. How are you this morning?
Well, not too shabby.
Yeah, you look pretty good.
Yeah.
So tell our listeners a little bit about you. You served as a Superior Court judge here in Vermont. You're also the Chief Administrative Judge. Talk about how you got into the legal profession.
Oh, well, when I was in the Army, after I graduated from college, I was in the Army, and one of my friends had talked about going to law school, and so I decided that I would go, and I went to George Washington University down in Washington, D.C. And while I was there, I very fortunately, Lola Parati got me a job when I was in my last year in law school as a doorkeeper up in the Senate. So I spent a year listening to Lyndon Johnson orate and Everett Dirksen, and John Kennedy was a senator at that time.
Wow.
Well, anyway, after I left, finished law school in the summer of 1959, I came back to Vermont and entered Dick Davis's law office and clerked there. Took my bar that fall. I was lucky enough to pass. And right then, at that time, Dick was involved with this particular case. And so I did a lot of research and running around, interviewing witnesses and whatever in connection with it. And when the second trial took place, Dick represented Frank Carpenter. In April of 1960, he allowed me to sit at counsel table. And so I took notes while Dick defended Frank Carpenter.
Describe to us what was going on in the last week of December in the life of Orville Gibson, and I guess more specifically he and the man that worked for him in the spilt milk. Talk about that.
Well,
it's a case that all started over spilt milk.
That's right. Eri Martin was his hired man. He was 59 years old or so, and Orville was around 45 or 6. And he'd worked for Martin had worked for Orville for 5 years. But Eri was known to enjoy a glass of wine.
Or two.
Or two, perhaps. Anyway, on Christmas Day, here I was celebrating on Christmas. I had a little wine to drink, and when he showed up for chores that evening, why, he was slightly inebriated, I guess. And during chores, while he was rolling two milk cans of milk to the milk house, why, he spilled the milk, and lo and behold, a tussle took place. And while Orville would never admit it, he did a number on poor Eri, and Eri eventually was in bed for several days, and the doctor had come to see him and to nurse his wounds.
And Orville was about 185, and Eri was about 115. He really kind of beat the crap out of him, didn't he?
I would say so, yeah.
Now, there's a description at one point when they're interviewing Orville about it, and the way he describes what he did to him, he's, well, you know, I mean, I hit him, but I didn't really hit him that hard or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, he downplayed it and wanted to make it look like that it was really Eri's fault for coming to work drunk, and that that's why he spilled the milk, and that's why he got hurt. He would never admit that he did any damage to Eri.
What was the reaction of townspeople to this?
Oh, the townspeople were very upset. And there were several people who had come to visit Eri at his house, which was right next to Orville's, and sharing their condolences for what had happened. And money was collected, and foodstuff was collected at Kernan's store, which is now the Newberry General store.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the week, Senator, Senator, well, anyway, someone suggested that maybe he ought to be tarred and feathered. And that caught on in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then a fellow by the name of David Miller,
mm-hmm.
who was a traveling salesman for a frozen food company, he and a bunch of rowdies at the store got to talking about the case, and, gee, maybe we ought to invite him downtown or up to the village to give him a teach him a piece of his own lesson, give him a lesson. And sure enough, he gave a call. And he talked, he didn't talk with Orville, he talked with his wife, Evelyn. And suggested to Evelyn that Gibson come up to the village and he would get a piece of his own medicine. And she was pretty upset over that. And later, I think she gave a call to her pastor, and he came and consoled her, went over to the barn where Orville was, and spoke to him. And Orville was very noncommittal about it. And one thing led to another.
What talk about his reputation before this in town? Well-liked, not well-liked?
He was very aloof. He stuck to his farm. He didn't participate in local affairs. He never went to church. He rarely went to the store. His wife did all of the shopping.
You're right. He never went to the chicken pie suppers.
That's right. never took her anywhere. He had disputes with his family or his wife's family. Who owned the farm. His wife's father owned the farm next door, which was north towards the village.
Mm-hmm.
She often would go over there and visit with her father and her brother. And Orville had gotten into a dispute with his brother and wouldn't speak to him.
For 9 years, you said?
9 years.
I mean, wow. And it seemed over something pretty minor.
Very minor.
Yeah. So on, so Orville goes one morning on the last day of the year, and goes into to the barn to milk the cows, and then he disappears.
Well, he never got to milk any cows.
All right, so he got to the barn, but he never milked
the
cows.
That's right, he never milked a cow.
All right, so what happened then?
Well, it's my position that at that point he had decided that he was going to commit suicide, and I say he went over, cross over to the barn, and that he crushed the pail with his foot. He stepped on it. That's his way to show his anger to his wife and to anybody else. Then he filled a bag full of silage and walked down to the bridge, which is a half a mile away. There was little snow on the ground, even though it was in December, and got down on the bridge, climbed down on the pier of the bridge, as shown on the cover of my book, and tied himself in the fashion that he was tied and rolled into the river.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why would he have committed suicide, Steve?
Because he had lost control of his life. By beating up the hired man, he'd never been to a court before, and he'd never been in a fight like that before, and he did a real number on Eri, and the townspeople reacted to it. And criticized him for having been beaten up in this fashion, and his life was shattered. He knew he was going to get sued. In fact, he did get sued, or the estate did. And his life was within that week was destroyed. He lost his hired man, so he had to milk 60 cows by himself. Eventually hired a young man who was a senior in high school to help him. He would only, the person he hired had only worked one day while he was alive, then came the second day and did chores by himself because Orville was down on the bridge rolling himself in.
You really believe this theory?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, there were some people that were kind of mad at him in town. It wouldn't have been a stretch because, you know, really what the point of this book is that, as you point out, the conventional wisdom is that he was killed by the townspeople as in revenge.
Absolutely no evidence to support that. None.
What's the evidence to support that he committed suicide? Did he leave a note or anything? Did he tell his wife that he was unhappy?
Freeman Placy's creation. When Evelyn discovered that Orville was missing, that was about at 8 o'clock, she called two people. She called the state police, Washburn, Billy Washburn, and then she called Freeman Placy. Freeman Placy was an old boyfriend of hers. In fact, Freeman had ended up marrying Evelyn's sister. Freeman was the first one to arrive at the farm before the police officer did. He went over to the house and spoke with Evelyn. Don't know what was said there. But then he came over to the barn and then immediately created the vigilante theory. He pointed out to the police. The police didn't point out to him. He pointed out to the police. See the silage? See the trail that goes down to the roadway? Aha! He was thrown into a vehicle and taken to the bridge. Now let's go down to the bridge and see what we can find down there. It was his idea to go to the bridge. And lo and behold, they get to the bridge, and aha, they see some silage strewn on the bridge. And it could only have come from the barn. And the silage was taken to Dr. Sproston up at the University of Vermont, and he said that the silage in the barn and the silage at the bridge was strikingly similar. How did that silage get to the bridge? The only conclusion that can be drawn is that Orville Gibson carried it there. He wanted to create the impression. He was a man of control. He wanted to control his life completely. And that's the way he ran his farm. And that's the way he ran his life. Total control. And then when he beat up the hired man, he lost his control then.
Mm-hmm.
And then the police officer came and interviewed both men and made a report to the state's attorney, Bud Ottoman, and Bud Ottoman issued a breach of peace charge against Orwell. And he was supposed to go to court on that Saturday, or that Monday, following New Year's. And
we're talking with former Judge Stephen Martin. He's written a book about the Orville Gibson case called Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. So they find Orville's body 3 or so months later, March of 1958.
Yeah, March of 26.
Tell me, talk about the condition of the body.
Body was in great condition.
Come on.
I mean, for a person who'd been in the water for 86 days...
I guess it's relative.
Well, you know, his clothing were not just rumpled. He had a pencil and his vest pocket on his overalls, and the point wasn't broken. Of course, the pictures are in the book that show the condition of his body. The part of his body that disintegrated to a considerable degree was his face, and that's because it was exposed. Everything else was covered by clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, his hands weren't covered, but.
Mm-hmm. So the police come in. They think that there's been some kind of foul play that's happened.
Oh, the foul play, as I've indicated to you the beginning of our interview, Placey created that within an hour after he came to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And that never varied.
Okay. But it wasn't like he made it up out of thin air. There were people that had threatened Orville. There were people that were really mad at him, too.
Well, they were upset that he'd beat up the hired man.
And they threatened him and said, you know...
Well, not in a vicious sort of way, that they were really going to come up and do a number on him. Well, this is what we ought to do. It was the fellow who said he ought to be tarred and feathered.
Mm-hmm.
He was an elderly man. Why it is, I can't remember what his name is.
Sorry, I'll find it here. So who did the police investigated? First person they talked to is the farmhand. He had an alibi of some kind.
Well, he was nursing his wounds. He was lying in the living room on a bed with a window that was facing the barn. And he was a frail fellow to begin with, wiry,
mm-hmm.
and much older than Orville. And he was certainly not a person who could in any way have attacked Orville or done him any harm.
So the police wound up, two people wound up getting charged. Who were they and why were they picked? Why were they charged?
Well, okay, keep in mind that the disappearance took place on New Year's. And the body wasn't found until 86 days later. And then some time later, well, first of all, I should mention that the police went to see Dr. Ford, who was a pathologist and medical examiner in Boston, and went to see the former medical examiner for Vermont, who was living in Philadelphia and who was the chief medical examiner in Philadelphia, a fellow by the name of Spellman. And the pictures of Gibson's body were shown to both of these men, and their immediate reaction was it was suicide. And the reason why they say it was suicide, that no one would have tied him up in that fashion in which he was tied. The only way he could have been tied in that fashion is if he did it himself. And they were very emphatic about that. But see, Dr. Woodruff, who was the one who conducted the hurried autopsy at the funeral home on the evening that Gibson was discovered, he announced that Gibson was dead before he hit the water. Well, all right, if that was in fact so, why, it would be obviously that somebody else threw him in.
Right.
I'd agree with that.
Yep.
Even the five-minute detective could figure that one out.
But when Archie Welch was tried in the first case, he changed his... the doctor changed his mind. He says, no, he was... he drowned. He was alive when he went into the water. So that completely changed the... or raised the idea that suicide occurred. Mm-hmm. But by that time, everyone was convinced it was a vigilante killing.
Now, why would... What's the theory that you have? You tie your hands underneath yourself so that you don't somehow try to save yourself? What's the theory? Why would you tie your own... Why would you tie your own
hands? I presented that he wanted to make it look like he was tied up by somebody and killed. He wanted to make it look like a vigilante murder.
Hence the Orville's revenge.
Yeah. I'm saying that he tied himself up in this fashion to make it look like somebody else did it. And this was his way of getting back at the community for accusing him of beating up his hired man, which he did do. But he didn't want to face that. And he certainly didn't want to have to go to court and face the music there. So that's my answer.
Mm-hmm. So Joe Heaney, an intrepid reporter for the Burlington Free Press, comes in, and you pretty harshly describe him as a guy who's kind of ambitious, trying to become an investigative reporter. And he kind of comes in, and I guess you might call it whips the flames up. So what happened?
Well, he was under the direction of his employer, which was Mr. McClure. McClure was the publisher of the Free Press, and for whatever reason, he was convinced that it was a vigilante murder. And he directed Joe Heaney to go over there and do an investigation and find out who the culprits were.
And he interviewed a ton of people.
Oh, yeah. He was there for 6 months, and he interviewed everybody. And, of course, most of them ended up being subjected to a lie detector test down in Concord, New Hampshire, because Vermont didn't have a lie detector machine. But McClure was the one really behind it. He was the one who offered the reward. He's the one who wrote... For 20 years, he offered a reward and asked people to write letters to the Free Press, which would be shared with the Attorney General and try to solve this case as a vigilante killing.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd call up the Attorney General. He'd write letters to the Attorney General. I'm here to help. the paper, the Free Press... through McClure.
Right.
Immediately took the attitude. It was a vigilante killing, and they're going to help the state police to find out who did it.
Did in any of Joe Heaney's reporting, was there anybody that in any way corroborated that theory?
No.
That it was vigilantes?
No. There's no corroboration to the vigilante theory.
All right. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about the two people that were charged, what happened in their case, and then what happened after that, too. So we're going to take a short break. You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. We've been talking with former Judge Stephen Martin, the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. We'll be back right after this.
At Morrisville's newest store, Mattress Sofa Warehouse, you'll find lots of affordable gifts for Christmas. Literally hundreds of recliners starting at just $279. Hundreds of sleep sets with queen mattress sets starting at just $299. Affordable pillows, sheet sets, end tables, coffee tables, and more. Mattress Sofa Warehouse offers everyday fair pricing and everyday no interest payment options. Every day. Stop in at the brand new Mattress Sofa Warehouse, Gallery Lane, off the new Route 100 Morrisville Bypass. MattressSofaWarehouse.com.
Hi folks, this is Jerry Booth. In 1946, when my family started Booth Brothers Dairy, they knew the farmers and where their milk came from. In today's world, everyone is concerned about where their food supply comes from. At Booth Brothers, it's the same as it was in 1946. 27 local farm families who supply us with quality milk, produced right here in central Vermont. So ask yourself, do you know where your milk comes from? Remember, the next time you're in the dairy aisle, reach for Booth Brothers.
We make a gravy from the drippings and have it with mashed potatoes and the veggies and all the fixes.
Bill McKenzie talks about McKenzie hams.
Well, first off, they start with a quality fresh ham. It's trimmed, and the curing itself is an overnight process. From there, they go into the smokehouse, and then they, after they're cured and smoked, they go in, you know, they're packaged and put in a box to be shipped to the stores. Well, you should choose McKenzie ham because you certainly be have all your guests raving about the taste and the quality of the ham.
McKenzie, wherever fine meat are sold.
Sure, he hasn't changed.
All right, hold on there. Hold on. Save that story. We're back. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. We've been talking with Stephen Martin, the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. We're talking about a case in the mid-50s in Newbury with the disappearance and then the appearance of Orville Gibson in the river with his hands tied underneath his legs. And Steve's theory here is that it was suicide. Many in the community think it was a vigilante revenge for Orville beating up his farmhand. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. All right, who were the two people that were charged, and why were they charged? What was their what was the connection the police saw?
Well, they were charged based solely on the testimony of Dr. Hooker. By the way, I should correct you. At the beginning, you said this took place on New Year's Eve. It didn't. It took place the night before New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it. All right.
Well, Dr. Hooker was the one who fingered both Frank and Ozzy. Dr. Hooker had picked up a hitchhiker around midnight on the day in question in Wells River and taken him to White River to catch the train. He was a he was in the armed services. And he needed to catch the 1:30 train to go to Camp Lejeune down in, what is it, north of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And after he dropped off this serviceman, he went over to the Polka Dot Restaurant in White River and had a piece of pie or whatever. And then meandered back up towards his home, which was at the time was in Wells River. And he says that when he came by the Gibson farm, about 500 feet or between 500 and 1,000 feet south of the Gibson barn, he saw a car, which he identified as being Frank Carpenter's car. And he went by the car, he said, around 40 miles per hour. And that as he was traveling by the car, keep in mind, it was around 20 degrees temperature. This is on the 30th of December, or now at this point it was the 31st, the early hours of the 31st. There was exhaust coming from the exhaust, and there was ice particles on the windows. And he went by at 40 miles an hour, and he identifies Ozzy sitting in the back seat and Frank in the front seat. keep in mind this car had a bad muffler. Everyone agrees it had a very bad muffler, and it was sitting right there in front of Earl Page's house. And if you are going to believe Dr. Hooker, that this car had been sitting with an idling fashion, waiting for a signal from people in the barn that they had Gibson, and making all this racket. And the Pages, both husband and wife, say that they didn't hear any bad muffler in front of their house at this particular time. And they said the dog obviously didn't hear it either, because if he had, he would have barked. All right, and that's it. And then you build the theory that when a signal arose, which is no evidence of that, and that Frank drove up to the barn, and that they dragged Gibson out of the barn. Even the authorities figured there were seven to 12 people involved in this event, and they hadn't only or at any time ever to identify two. And the two that were identified was by Dr. Hooker. And anyway, they dragged him out, and the car idling there in front of the Gibson house and in front of Eri Martin's house, and neither one of these people heard any muffler, idling muffler noise at this particular occasion. And then the theory is that they was taken to the bridge. And how the silage got to the bridge was never explained, because no silage was ever found in Frank Carpenter's car.
Was Dr. Hooker the one that had to withstand that withering cross-examination about his eyeglasses?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That pretty much slammed that guy. That was like a total Perry Mason moment, where it was like, okay, you're nearsighted, and then you basically destroyed the guy.
Yeah. Because that's the heart of the case, in my view, to show what kind of a lawyer that Dick Davis really was. He really did a number on.
Did you help prepare him for that?
Oh, I was there and talked with him, and sure, I would give him suggestions. Whether he took my suggestions to heart, who knows? Probably not. But
so,
I did as much as I could to help him, and... Well, one funny thing did happen. A lady got on the stand. I forget now what her name was. I had interviewed her, and she was a lady who worked in the plywood factory in Bradford. And she had said that she came by the farm around 4 o'clock, 2 minutes before or 2 minutes after. And that she didn't see any activity of any sort around the barn. That was a pretty strong evidence to indicate nothing was going on at the time it was allegedly being hauled off and taken to the bridge. But I had interviewed this lady, and I'd taken a statement. Dick, out of the blue, I was sitting next to him, you know, here taking notes, and out of the blue, he said, "You cross-examine." So I got up and I held on to my chair as best I could, asked her a few questions, and said, "Anything more, Dick?" "No, that's okay."
Yeah. This is your mentor. A lot of pressure there, huh? Yeah. So there is a directed verdict, an acquittal. That
was in the Welch case.
Okay. So tell me what happened in this case.
Well, of course, Fred Reed was the one who tried the first case. And Henry Black and Peter Plant defended Ozzie Welch. Henry Black was the lead lawyer for the defense. And after the evidence was presented, and the only evidence they had that Frank and Ozzie, or that Ozzie in this case, was anywhere near the scene, was Dr. Hooker's testimony. And there was one other piece of evidence that they connected Ozzie with a case, was that during his during an interview, well, within a few days after But Gibson was found in the river while the state police set up an interrogation center at the motel there in Wells River.
Mm-hmm.
And Ozzie was called, along with many other people. And when he was shown the rope, it was the piece of rope that tied up Gibson. It was about 80, 88 inches long. He allegedly said, "Gee, that's my rope." And so they made a big deal out of that. Mm-hmm. They have him identified in the car by Hooker, 500 feet south of the barn, and then an admission that it was his rope. And that's all they had.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, they concluded he took part in the killing.
Mm-hmm. So what was the reaction to that directed verdict of acquittal in town?
Oh, they were up in arms. And Fred Reed made a remark to a reporter that he was not unhappy with the verdict or the decision of the judge to throw it out. Hey, gosh, the town went up in arms, and a fellow by the name of what was his name? Well, anyway, this fellow developed a petition and had several people sign it, suggesting that, and it was sent to the governor and wanted to have an investigation of the Attorney General's office and the state police and
FBI.
So on.
FBI.
The FBI, bring the FBI in. And as a result, Fred Reed resigned and became a general counsel for Rock of Ages, and that's when Tom Debevoise came in.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Debevoise was a young fellow who had been appointed deputy attorney general, and he took over the case for against Carpenter.
So tell us then what happened in that case.
In
Carpenter.
Well, essentially, the jury brought back a not guilty verdict, and they deliberated, I don't know, 4 hours or so. And that ended the, after that verdict, that essentially ended the investigation of the case. Well, I'll take that back. The commissioner asked Sergeant Vautour from the Vermont State Police, who was up in St. Albans, to come and do a thorough investigation, which he did. And nothing has occurred since. But Vautour made some interesting... He wasn't able to find any needles in the haystack. He wasn't able to find any vigilante killers. He couldn't quite bring himself to say to his superiors or to his friends, his buddies in the state police, that there was a suicide, but he came awful close.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be glad to read those reasons if you think that would be of interest here.
And while you look for that, let me just take a moment to remind our listeners about our good friends at Green Mountain Access. If you're looking for an outstanding local internet service provider, make it our friends at gmavt.net. You can call them right now toll-free at 1-888-321-0815. That's 1-888-321-0815, and on the web at gmavt.net. We've been talking with former Judge Stephen Martin. He's the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. Did you find what you wanted?
Yes. Vautier's assignment was to start from scratch, and I'm reading from my book, start from scratch and conduct a thorough examination of the facts and circumstances surrounding Gibson's death. He carefully and meticulously reviewed the 236 statements that were taken, the voluminous records of the investigating officers, the lie detector results, the testimony presented to the grand jury, and the testimony taken at the inquest hearings held after the directed verdict in the Wells case. On top of that, he conducted his own comprehensive investigation and witness interrogation. He found no vigilante murderers lurking in the haystack. His only substantive recommendation was to subject everyone to another lie detector test. Now, he couldn't quite bring himself to tell his colleagues and superiors that Gibson committed suicide, but he came awfully close. Here is a verbatim list of reasons he presented in his report. The following would indicate that Orville Gibson could possibly have committed suicide. One, the $120 in cash found in the drawer by Mrs. Gibson was apparently the money from Orville Gibson's wallet. It is apparent that it was put there just prior to his disappearance. Two, the apparent taking of several checks from a wallet by Orville Gibson and placing them in a desk drawer in the dining room. These checks were found by Mrs. Gibson on February 25, 1958, and according to the statement, Mrs. Gibson was upset as there was now an indication of suicide. Three, on February 8, 1958, Mrs. Gibson revealed she had given Orville a fishbowl for Christmas, and when he opened it, he looked funny and said, "I will never use it." Four, Mrs. Evelyn Gibson stated, if Orville had committed suicide, he would have walked down through the fields and possibly up the tracks to the bridge. Suicide is one thing I would not want him to have done. This statement was made on February 8, 1958. Five, Mrs. Gibson advised the evening of December 30, 1957, Orville's mind was miles away. Oh, that's just a few hours before he disappeared. Six, the paying on December 30, 1957 of the wages of $20 owed George Cushing from the middle of November 1957 appears to be strange.
That is one of the great stories in this book, where they interview that guy talking about getting the money. Oh, I can't really remember what day that was he got it. He's just, that guy's just lying so blatantly in the interview that they do with him.
Yeah. Seven, in Mrs. Sherwin's statements, it would indicate that Orville Gibson had some idea of the affections of Freeman Placy towards his wife Evelyn, and possibly was brooding over this and also knew of her affections towards Freeman Placy. Eight, with a telephone call received on December 30, 1957 from David Miller, and the fact that he knew that the townspeople were angered over the Martin beating, this probably also worked on Orville Gibson's mind. Nine, it is a known fact that the tests used in the state laboratory at Burlington on carbon monoxide from blood is not an accurate one, and thus would relieve any doubt as to the carbon monoxide in his blood at the time of the death of Orville Gibson. Ten.
That's important because it would indicate if he died before he went in the river or after, right?
Well, the claim was that he picked up the carbon monoxide in Frank Carpenter's trunk. That's how he was. They tied Orville with Frank's car. And the chorus of our experts, Dr. Ford, Spellman, and a fellow by the name of the chief chemist, Stratton, from the Boston Police Department, no, he didn't have any carbon monoxide in his blood. That all arose out of putrefaction, having been in the water for 86 days.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, the 10, Dr. Woodruff on the stand testified to the fact that death was caused by suffocation by drowning, by changing his mind. 11, the injury to the kidney and also the fat droplets in the lung, according to Dr. Woodruff, occurred in less than 24 hours from the time of death. He did not state how soon after they occurred that these droplets would appear in the lungs. And 12, it is possible for Gibson to have arranged the scene at the barn and then gone to the bridge, placed some more silage on the bridge, then tied himself up, and rolled off into the river. In so doing, he could have struck one of the cement piers in the center of this bridge, thereby giving his injuries and also the cut on his cheek.
Mm-hmm.
You
had me at the fishing pole. I was convinced that he'd committed suicide.
Okay.
When he said he never was going to use the fishing pole. So we're going to take a break here, and I hope you don't have anywhere to go because we have a couple of other topics on this. Because next we're going to talk about how this myth continued to get fueled, and we'll talk about some of the characters that have helped fuel that myth, including Candy Page, formerly of the Burlington Free Press, and our friend Frank Bryan will drag through this story as well, too. We'll take a quick commercial break. We'll be back right after this.
Supermarkets with no personality. This is Tom Mihuron, and I invite you to shop our well-stocked, right-sized family market in Waitsfield. Custom-cut meats, fresh seafood and produce, gourmet cheeses, regular and organic groceries, and over 1,000 wines. Come and see Jeff and Bill in the meat department, Tana and produce, Gary in seafood, Nate in the deli, or Nancy and Liz in our incredible wine department. Family-run for over 70 years. Mihuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center in Waitsfield.
RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Rob Weiss from the Central Vermont Council on Aging.
I went to RB Technologies because I was looking for a migration from our older technology server to a newer technology, but I went to a number of different companies. I settled on RB Technologies because they are local. I didn't feel talked down to, which was really important. With RB Technologies, you get a feeling that they're really there to help you. They're not there to like try to sell you something that you don't need. They're there to listen to you, and they'll make recommendations, and they won't do anything without asking about if that's what you want to do, and I found that to be invaluable.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies. Efficiency through technology.
Happy holidays from Walker Volkswagen on the Barrie Montpelier Road. This holiday season, we are pleased to announce the holiday year-end employee pricing event to all of our current customers and future customers as well. A big holiday thank you from us to you. You pay what we pay for your new Volkswagen, saving you thousands of dollars. We won't be beat on price or payment. Just call, stop by, or go to walkervt.com for your employee price. Then take advantage of 0% financing for up to 60 months on select Volkswagen models and save even more. Or consult us on a sign-then-drive lease for as low as $165 with zero down on a European-style, German-engineered Volkswagen. It's the end of another great year, and Walker Volkswagen is determined to finish 2014 with a bang, a big bang. Deeply discounted employee pricing plus generous factory incentives combined to make a new Volkswagen a great holiday surprise. Call, stop by, or click walkervt.com on the very Montpelier Road and join us at the holiday year-end employee pricing event.
Happy holidays!
I'm Talia from Onion River Kids. We're excited to get you and your child outside this winter, so we have packed Onion River Kids with things to help you do that, like our Strider bike, a small pedalless bike. Their feet can go on the ground immediately if they start to become unbalanced, but there's a ski attachment and they push themselves along. For a newborn in your family, we have lots of baby joggers that have large tires on them so that you can push them through the slush on the sidewalk. We have many different baby carriers with attachments for when you're out cross-country skiing. We know you have tons of things to do during this holiday season, but we want to make it easy for you. We'll even do the gift wrapping. We have things for kids from infant all the way up to your preteen. Every kid wants a cool water bottle, and we've got them. There's lots of affordable little gifts for them to buy for their little friends. I don't even want to go into the stocking stuffers we have. There are so many. Onion River Kids on Langdon Street in Montpelier. We'd love to see you, and happy holidays.
I love the Hunger Mountain Food Co-op because of the wide variety of quality and local food. I'm Irvin Eisenberg from Montpelier, Vermont, and I've been a member of the Hunger Mountain Co-op since 2008.
Hi, I'm Ruth at Goodrich's Maple Farm, inviting you to visit our gift shop where we have a large selection of maple syrup and gifts for your holiday shopping. You can also shop online at goodrichmaplefarm.com. Santa will be joining us on Saturday, December 20th from 1 to 3 at Goodrich's Maple Farm on Route 2 in Cabot.
Give the flavor of Vermont this Christmas from Goodrich Maple Farm, Route 2 in Cabot, family owned since 1840.
Back, we've been talking with the judge this morning, Judge Stephen Martin, and we've been talking about his book, Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. Let's head to Corinth. Forbes, how are you doing this morning?
Good, Mark. How are you?
All right.
That's quite a story, historically. It's probably the biggest known secret in the town of Newbury. It'll be interesting to hear actually what the good judge personally feels happened there.
The biggest known secret in town. You have not, Judge, convinced Forbes on this one.
Apparently not.
Yeah.
What's the secret?
So he wants to know what I just asked you during the break here, which is, come on, do you really believe this theory?
Yes.
And you do.
It's the only theory that works. That's the only way to explain it. And there are several key items, but the most important one is the silage. How come there was no silage in Frank's trunk? If there's no silage in Frank's trunk, it's highly unlikely that Orville Gibson was ever there.
Kind of break the link.
Breaks the link.
Let's talk a couple of people. Let's talk about what happened after this, because this story really, in a lot of ways, I mean, part of what you write about in this book is how this myth has been continued. And among those are some of the state's newspapers that have regularly gone back and written stories, unsolved murders in Vermont. Some have looked in this particular case. Talk about Candy Page, who used to work at the Burlington Free Press, and her coverage of this story.
Okay, Candy Page first became involved in this case, as far as I can tell, was in 1978 when she was writing for the United Press International. And she wrote a story on April 5, 1978 that appeared in the Caledonian Record. And her storyline was familiar, and it varied little from various accounts written by countless commentators, except for one difference. She told her readers what Newbury Town Clerk Lillian Knight thought about the case. Now, Lillian Knight was the quintessential town clerk for the town of Newbury, and this is what Miss Page said about her. Across the green from Kernan's store, Lillian Knight, 40 years the town clerk, lives in one of the big white houses that makes Newbury the perfectly photographable New England town. Mrs. Knight will talk, but only to tell you there is nothing to talk about. She stands in the midst of a low-pitched room full of old New England-style furniture, smoothing her white hair. I'll tell you what happened to Orville Gibson. He committed suicide. It was terrible. The police coming in here and dragging every man in town off for a lie detector test. I could tell you some things about those policemen. Nobody could say anything bad about Orville Gibson. He worked hard. He was ambitious. Maybe he had his oddities, but which of us doesn't? He kept to himself, he and his wife. Maybe some of the men in town were jealous. You get feelings like that when somebody is successful. She doesn't think Welch and Carpenter had anything to do with the murder. I know enough people from families like theirs, drinkers, and if they had done it, everybody in town would have known. Well, on January 1st, 2004, Miss Page authored another distressingly similar article about the Gibson case, only this time she was writing for the Burlington Free Press. The headlines read, 46 years later, infamous crime remains unsolved. Who killed Orville Gibson? Gibson family hopes to solve 1957 killing. Well, Miss Page's storyline had not changed, except for one very important difference. Lillian Knight's assessment that Gibson committed suicide was not mentioned.
No further questions, Counselor.
No further questions.
Let's go to Barry. Larry, good morning.
The judge remembers things just a little bit differently than I do. As I recall, they did find silage in the car, and they did find fragments of the rope in the car. And I think probably that a lot of people would agree that had this case been tried somewhere other than in Orange County, had been tried over in Addison County or Bennington County or somewhere, it would have been a lot different because the people that were listening within neighbors and friends and so forth. So that's the way I feel. And I do remember it very well because I was with the state police at that time in 1958.
Wow, okay. So there were rope fragments and silage fragments?
No.
As I remember, they were, yeah.
All right, that's a key fact here.
Ackman from St. Johnsbury worked on that case for a long time, and I was stationed in St. Johnsbury at that time.
Well, the testimony for the grand jury, there was no silage in the trunk, and there were no fragments of the rope.
Would you admit if Larry's right on this that your whole theory kind of goes out the window?
It certainly does.
All right.
Yep. My theory wouldn't hold water if those two facts are true, and I say, of course, they aren't.
Right. Do you also agree that it had been tried in Addison County or Bennington County or somewhere else where it would have been a different outcome?
Well, I'm saying that because of the way in which the rules were interpreted back in those days, and the defense counsel were not able to inspect evidence that the state police had, there wouldn't have been any trials. The cases would never have been tried. If the state police had accepted the opinions of Dr. Spellman and Dr. Ford, which they knew within a month after Gibson's body was found, and both of those eminent, qualified medical examiners said it was suicide. If they had been willing to accept that rather than to accept or go along with Dr. Woodruff, there would have been no trials.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. You're listening to FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. All right, let's talk about my friend. I'm sorry, we're going to do our quick, we'll do our White House report, and then we'll get back to our discussion with Judge Stephen Martin. He's the author of Orville's Revenge. We go to Washington, D.C. Joining us today from Talk Radio News Service, here's Ellen Ratner. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning to you.
What's going on?
Okay, well, we have a bill that passed by one vote in the House. It was 219, you need 218 votes to pass. Not pretty.
This is to keep the government open.
This is to keep the government open.
With those two, and you mentioned this yesterday or the day before, there are these two provisions, one of which particularly is just gross, that will allow individuals to donate and ton of money to political campaigns or political parties.
Right. And so, listen, this ups it times three. Sorry, times ten.
Yeah.
The 300,000. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an. What's the other provision in there that's problematic?
There's a lot of problematic, but. So that is one of them, and the other is the issue. Now I'm having a senior moment. One is the issue of Dodd-Frank, and really stripping a lot of the safety net there in terms of derivatives,
right.
And that's a big concern.
Right, right, okay. So what happens next with this?
Well. Unclear what happens next. It will go to the Senate. The Elizabeth Warren group does not want it to pass. But I think that it will pass. I don't think there's a question of that. I think they probably have the votes necessary. They need the 60 votes. They'll get the Republicans to do this.
And the president has signaled that he'll sign it.
That's right.
All right. What's going on the blowback from the torture report?
Well, the big blowback on this, of course, is what the CIA director said yesterday at the CIA, that he doesn't know, basically he doesn't know yet whether it works or not, although all the report says it does not work, that in terms of whether they would ever use it again, well, that would be up to the political situation at the time. That isn't what the decision the CIA makes. He did apologize for them going over.
Mm-hmm. All right. He didn't seem to, well, his testimony I thought was kind of odd yesterday, but anyway, anything coming up next week you want to mention?
Coming up next week, I mean, we don't really know. It depends whether Congress stays in session or not.
Okay, I guess it depends on what happens with this budget deal more than anything, right?
Exactly.
All right.
This is going to determine all of next week, because frankly, if this is out of session, the president will go to Hawaii at the end of next weekend. Then, you know, Washington closes down for Christmas parties, and that's about it.
Right. Anything else you want to mention?
I think the other big issues right now are the other things that are in this bill. And there's everything from safety of embassies to not as much money as the president wanted for Ebola. So that's a major concern. The question is, how are they going to fund the conventions? But, of course, if they keep this provision in, they can get the big donors to give a lot of money, and that funds the conventions. They need about $18 million.
All right. Have a nice weekend, all right?
Thank you. You
Thank
too.
You. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. We've got to take a quick break here. We'll be back, continue our discussion. We'll pick up the story of Orville Gibson with Judge Stephen Martin back after this.
Plainfield Hardware and General Store is now a proud retailer of darn tough socks. Made in Northfield. Wear them around the house and put holes in them.